'60s. How long were we in the land set aside program? 10 years? For exactly the same reason. Overproduction was driving everybody to the bankruptcy wall. I have never heard anybody come before this committee nor the Senate committee that said, let's divide the state of Oregon up into 5-acre pieces. There has been a consistent pattern and a consistent concern of the small property owner that bought land 5, 10, 15, 2 years ago. But it's 5, 10, 15 acres. It is not a commercial farm under any concept. Except possibly a strawberry grower or a tulip bulb grower or something that's an intensive farm operation. And there are few Americans that are intensive farmers. The strawberry people are screaming because the strawberries came on 2 weeks early and no one will pick strawberries. And we still have a 9% unemployment rate in the state. We have thousands of acres in Benton County alone that is devoted to Christmas tree growing. They get all of the benefits of the farming operation. They get the tax deferral. They get the income tax back off. They get the no property tax, personal property tax payment. And then on top of that, everything that they make is capital gains. And on a personal basis, I would submit that at this day and age, with the cover crop problem in the first 2 or 3 years of Christmas tree growing, that Christmas trees do more damage to the land than any other singular crop. But I still support the Christmas tree industry. But it's nothing but a cash crop. That's all it is. To a great extent, the ryegrass is a cash crop, and it adds to the economy. But is it so important to the economy that all of the small property owners are driven off of their property or not allowed to do with it what they bought it under the circumstances and planned for? And does it, in effect, if I, in South Benton, put a house on a 20-acre piece, adversely affect somebody in North Benton County, which has been through the courts many, many times? The concept on the marginal land is excellent. But this doesn't do it. The right hand giveth, and the left hand taketh away. Page 2. The land did not make a significant contribution to a farm operation that produced $20,000 or more. In gross income in the last 3 to 5 years preceding the effective date. That's probably a good standard and could be lived with. I agree with AOC and the rest of them that said, is it the state's business and the county's business to start looking into the personal finances of every man that owns a 20-acre piece of property, or 15 or 100? But then it follows with, and the land is either located on not less than 100 acres, and the Farm Bureau would like it to be 1,000, of which at least 50% is composed of contiguous ownerships that are 20 acres or less. I would submit in Benton County, under the 100-acre criteria, that there is not one block of property that is not already designated urban growth or RR residential, which pulls it out of this criteria, that could be now declared marginal land. And I would further go on a limb, probably 99% of the property in the whole state of Oregon doesn't apply when you start using the 1 through 4 criteria for soil capability. I would like to recommend that this be thrown out the window and one singular thing tried. And I know Mr. Bradbury, or Representative Bradbury, had the concern about how many pieces of property are there in the state of Oregon if we had a true lot of record bill that took every legally parcelized piece on a legal basis and said, you're authorized to put a house on it. How many would there be? Well, I have a fair idea in Benton County. In the tax assessor's office, there's 20,000 pieces of property, 27,000 pieces of property on the tax assessment rolls. Of that, about 16 or 18,000 of them are in the city of Corvallis. That leaves 9. We have Albany, we have North Albany, which is an urban area, even though it's not in a city limit. We have the city of Monroe that has some 300 or 400 tax lots. And we also have the city of Philomath, which has another several hundred within a pretty large urban growth boundary. I would say that in Benton County alone, that there might be 2,000 or 3,000 on the outside that could come under a lot of record. But I cannot say of the 2,000 or 3,000 how many of them do now have a house on them. I can say in many, many instances that we have grass seed farmers like the Vanell that own and operate 7,000 or 8,000 acres of grass seed land, but probably includes 200 or 300 or 400 parcels. The same way with Mr. Bob Goracki, who supports this bill. He's a large grass seed farmer, but he owns many, many, many parcels of land. Sir, ma'am?
I said he doesn't own them all. He leases lots of them.
Too many of them, they are leased. That's right. But he's also a big buyer, too, Representative Van Leeuwen. And that, to me, I think is what the public was asking for when I went around and listened to the task force. We want some relief. We do not want to cut the state up into five-acre parcels. But those people that have bought legally should be recognized as being having a legal purchase, and let them put a house on it. If the Senate bill that was passed last year on the Farm Protection Bill is not strong enough, again I say, let's beef the Farm Protection Bill back up where he is protected. It now says that the farmer cannot be taken to court for prudent farm practices. Well, I think the farmer should be liable for prudent farm practices. If I go out and run my car into somebody, I'm supposed to be a prudent driver, otherwise he takes me to court and sues me. So let's try within the means that we have to protect everybody in the state equally. Because I think the farmer can be protected. And I know in the Monroe area, I have had a predominant more showings of the people joyriding out of Eugene, which is 20 miles away, causing damage to my property than I have from the citizens of Monroe. And I have children right next door and right across the street. And I'm in a rural community. I don't have very many problems with my neighbors. It has not been a predominant problem in the 23 years I've lived in Monroe. But I've had hunters come as far away from Klamath Falls and climb through the fences and cut them. I'll never legislate that out. You cannot legislate vandalism. You might be able to charge them if you can catch them, but you got to catch them. I would like to respond a little bit, if I might, to the Farm Bureau. I'm a member of the Farm Bureau at the very, very lowest level at the farm. I pay my $40 a year. And that's about to the extent to the annual dinner and the local meetings that I can attend that I have anything to do with it. Scott Ashkam represents the Farm Bureau Executive Committee. He does not represent me as a member of the Farm Bureau. And I'd like to refer to page 5, line 30.
Is this on the Senate
bill? On your version, ma'am.
Thank you.
The being gross. The dwelling or activities associated with the bill will not force a major change. He wants to eliminate, or by his assumption, the Bureau wants to eliminate the word major. Now we're right back into will not force a change. Anything that you do, any place, forces a change. Now we're right back into the courts and into Lubin, into LCDC, into the appeals court. I hate the word major because it does almost the same thing. Who defines what major is? It's an individual preference. There ought to be some better definition. The same way on page 6, line 1, the dwelling or activities associated with a dwelling will not force a major change. They want to eliminate it. Let's go back to court. We've been there for the last 10 years. Why should we change? I disagree with that totally as a Farm Bureau member. And goes on in line 2, increase the cost of accepted farm practice within 2 miles. God, that's a long ways away. If I affect the farm practice on the guy next door to me, and again, what's forced us in the courts, I sit in Monroe and a guy goes up here and burns a fire in North Benton County and I take him to court because he's interfering with my air. There has to be some consistency in pattern. We're getting far out of the pattern. On page 2, line 5 and 8, located in an area of less than 100 acres. They would extend that to 1,000 acres. I would submit that there's nothing in the entire Willamette Valley with 50% composed of contiguous ownerships less than 20 acre size that would ever be considered as marginal land. Again, I submit, I don't think there's any place in the state of Oregon when you throw in the 1 through 4 that you would run into that kind of a thing. So what you're in essence doing is saying, let's have marginal land, we'll put 1,000 acres on it, and we don't have any marginal land. The concept goes out the window because we restricted it too much. On line 8, same thing, basically. Now we've expanded. Right now, we have soil classifications 1 through 4, or EFU. Now we're talking forestry classes, which are presently 2 through 7, and they want to expand it to 8. Isn't enough enough? We've had experts in the Senate testify that somewhere around the soil classification test of 3 in the forestry zones is where you get marginally profitable forest land, the 85 cubic feet per year. They wouldn't even look at 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and they testified to that. So why are we putting it into the marginal category?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bradbury.
Maybe I'm confused, but maybe I'm wrong, but I think that the soil classifications they're talking about in page 2, line 8, are the normal agricultural soil classifications, not the timberland classifications. And I would find it hard to believe that something that could produce 85 cubic feet of merchantable timber would be marginal, given that there's a vast amount of timberland in eastern Oregon that produces no more than 50 cubic feet per year. And it's not marginal, it's very actively involved in warehouses, tree farms, and other people's tree farms.
In thousands of acres of tract.
Yeah.
But what do you do on a 20-acre piece that the owner does? Can he ever make a living on it? Can he ever meet an income test on it? And yet he owns the 20 acres. And as was said before, what does he do? Sell it to the guy next door that has the huge parcel for half the price that he paid for it. Because when he bought it, he could put a house on it. But he was off earning a living someplace. You see the point, Representative Bradbury?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've got to think of all of them. On page 11, on page 7, line 7, I think we have too many hearings panels now. But to fall into the concept of picking 3 selected farmers, and I don't care how honest they are, nor who the names are, nor who selects them. We talk about kids in the cookie jar. Here's a panel of 3 farmers, no matter who they are, that's going to look at a small piece of land and decide whether it's fair to put a house on it, call it non-farm dwelling, farm dwelling, marginal land, or whatever. I think it's ludicrous. It's like putting the crook in charge of the bank.
Who should do that?
Madam Chair.
Yeah. Representative Bradbury.
I gather in your analogy, the crook would want to be someone who could use his farmland.
or make the best use of the farmland.
That's the crook that we're putting in charge of the cookie jar.
I don't care how honest we are, Representative Bradbury. If I have a 20-acre piece next to me, and I own a 100-acre piece, and if the law is so written that I can force that man by refusing to put a house on it, that he has to sell it to somebody, and I'm the only one that can do anything with it to make a profit, then I kind of set the price. And I think that's a long distance from the free enterprise system.
Madam Chair?
Representative Hill.
It's my understanding that the purpose of having exclusive farm use zone is to keep the land that's productive under agricultural management. If that 20-acre piece is taken out of agricultural management because it's too small to be managed effectively, that defeats the purpose of the exclusive farm use zone. So the purpose of the zone is to keep that land in agricultural management. It's up to the owner of the 20-acre piece, I would say, to decide if they want to hold on to that land, even though it's not profitable to farm it or sell it. That's the whole point of the law.
You know, that's one thing, Representative Hill, to sell this land to the man 10 years ago, and at that time he could put a house on it, and he could raise crops because he's working 8 hours a day, but he spends his Saturdays and Sundays raising his small woodlot or having his 10 or 15 head of sheep, keeping the grass mowed, keeping the place in shape, doing the hand labor that he can, and living on it. But then, a year after he bought it, under those concepts, somebody says, hey, now you can no longer live on it. Now, I've already paid my $3,000 an acre for the small acreage. Now, the farmer next door, when somebody says, we'll put a law in, you can't put a house on it, Bob, I'll offer you $500 an acre. Now, both houses in these hallowed halls have gone through the concept of, if we want the land, let's buy it. And you threw that out the window because the state can't afford it under the payment of rezoning, downzoning land. And that didn't get any place in these two halls. Well, now let's be fair with the guy that does own it, and he bought it legally. And that's what this concept is supposed to do, but it's not doing it.
Would it be fair then to allow the 100-acre farm owner to sell off 20-acre parcels because he can make more money?
Not necessarily,
no. If a neighbor
no.
can sell his parcels for $3,000 an acre instead of $500, why doesn't he just divvy up his land into five pieces for $3,000 instead of $500? It'd never end. We wouldn't have any farmland left.
Oh, but wait a minute now. The man that has the 100 acres has the house on it, and he has three kids living next door because they're functioning in the farm operation. The only one that's getting the short end of the stick is the guy on the 20-acre parcel that's next door. He's doing with that 100-acre piece what he wants to do with it. And I think there's a great deal later down the road that if things get to the point that they're going in Oregon, that somebody better give the farmer an option to take some lousy land out of that 100 acres and keep from going bankrupt by selling a 20-acre piece. Because there's a lot of them on the verge, and they don't have any options. And they've worked their tails off. And the state can't farm it either. Now I'd like to go through just a couple other comments of all night. Lane County concerns. And a lot of the counties seem to have this option, and I can understand it, but I don't agree with it. The counties in many instances right now are more concerned about the hardship to the county staffs. We don't have money to mail out envelopes to tell these people what to do. We don't have money to go out and research whether he's making $20,000. So let's screw them all, and we'll do as we damn well please at the county level. They work for the citizens of the county. And I'm sorry about the hardships. And maybe it'll take a little longer to get it done. But it seems to me when we look at a bill like this, if it does the job we want, then the citizens become the primary support function. Not how hard the staff is going to work. I'm not the least bit interested in how hard the staff works. I see too many of them drinking coffee when I walk in the office. And that goes for all of the counties, all 36 of them. I don't think it's exceptional that Lane County is out in left field. They're not. The staffs are in left field. I think we're all in the same boat that we're damn tired of the LCDC land use planning hassle. We've been at it for 10 years and haven't gotten any place. You keep changing the rules. But it's something we're going to have to live with until we get it organized. And sooner or later, we'll get it organized. Representative Bradbury, you brought up the point on the hardship on the mobile home as one man.
No, I didn't, but...
Well, you wanted to know the criteria. And I would say in our county, we have hardships in EFU zone that puts a mobile home there. Our review criteria is on an annual basis, and the mobile home comes on when the hardship no longer exists. And it's a fairly workable plan. There is no permanent structure. It's a mobile home. And I think it's fair to the public. And in that instance, it should come also under the marginal, but also be in the EFU zone. And we do apply it in the EFU zone. And I think it's legal. Are there any questions? I'm tired.
I'd just like to raise a point. In Lane County, our county planning staff do work quite hard. Well, you just did.
No, I didn't.
They're on 4-day work weeks, and we've reduced their personnel by over 1/3. So I think the point they raised was a completely legitimate point. It's very difficult if we assign them extra work for them to do that with reduced personnel.
That's absolutely a fair assumption, Representative Hill. Mm-hmm. But do the citizens of the county stop getting what they're just due because we keep adding workloads onto the...
Now,
we are not here to argue how hard some planning council works. We're here to discuss Senate Bill 237. Thank you very much for coming, Matt and Carl. Welcome. Thank you for waiting in this nice hot room this long.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the Planning Environmental and Energy Committee. I have waited quite a while, but it was well worth it from the standpoint of hearing what others had to say. My name is Manton Carl, 13324 Carl Road, Hubbard. I'm a farmer with a real estate broker's license. I served for over 7 years on the Marion County Planning Commission and several years prior to that in the Marion County Land Use Advisory Committee. I'm in strong support of the intent of Senate Bill 237 and the provisions of it. Our food and fiber factories are our farms and forests, which are a water-storing, pollutant-absorbing, solar-heated resource base, providing far more property tax than it demands for public service. These factories provide their own development costs. The need is public support and laws for protection from non-farm and forest development that destroys or inhibits the productive capacity of these farm and forest factories. There have been examples given before today. I have some of my own where people next to me, there's a lady had 6 acres in the EFU zone. There are now 5 houses on this 6 acres because it was too small for an economic unit. Now, they thought this was a hardship. The lady owns a wheat ranch in eastern Oregon, in addition to her 2 acres that she has left where she lives. This is the type of hardship that is so often. Remember now, I spent 7 years on the Planning Commission and several years prior to that. I am in northern Marion County, which is one of the more productive areas in the of the state, and approximately 20 miles from here, my land comprises of all 7 different land classifications in which county uses for land classification, because there's a creek run through it, a border, a river, and there's an escarpment because between the upland and the bottom land and so forth. And if these were individually designated as marginal or for some other reason non-productive, they're all productive. The least productive part of my farm is my lawn. Everything else is productive, and I have in excess of 500 acres. But it's all producing something. And if the criteria is properly used, it can be contribute in some small way to the total. But I do find it annoying, which Representative Hill brought up, that someone that'll come in and have 5 acres, and he should be able to, and I have a neighbor with 3 apartments, an adjoining neighbor with 3 apartments, besides 2 other houses, 3 houses on his farm. Now, do we destroy my farm and let it all go to production, I mean to development, or do we stick to the purpose of our land use laws in the first place, to maintain our resource base? I owned a lot one time in the city of Hubbard, and a building adjacent to it, a vacant lot. This goes back to 1945, that's a few years ago. I bought it, that adjacent lot was zoned commercial. I paid $12 a year taxes on it, non-productive. Should I have been allowed to put anything I wanted to on it? It was a poor investment, that's what it was. I held it for 20 years. And to this day, that lot is still vacant. We must let that our zoning determine our investment and our chances that we're going to do, and not somebody's speculation. In other words, zoning determined the speculation, and not the speculation determined the zoning, which so much of it has done. And these people, I have several examples of the same thing. And each one that I have, the owner, it isn't that one lot that he owns plus renting someplace else. That's one of many investments that he has, and he screams his head off because he can't develop that one lot because he intended to, and he speculated on it. If he'd have bought stocks and they'd have went down, he'd want somebody to reimburse him. And there is so much of this. I don't know of a single case. They do exist, but I personally do not know of a single case of someone buying a lot and waiting for any number of years to put a house on it because this was his dream. And that was all he had. They have so many more in addition to that. These additional dwellings provide the dogs that kill our sheep, and quite a large of them, the adults and children that use our woodlot for hunting and camping out because we are neighbors. I had as many, over 100 at one time, congregate, not one of which I known, but they were neighbors. They were transients that come in, that one of them worked on the neighboring farm, but he brought in all his people that he knew. This last winter, the hunters, because they couldn't hunt, well, they shot at the swans that we try to protect, and they want to be able to do their thing. And I try to protect them because I do like to see them. Besides, there's a state law, not a state law, a national law protecting such wildlife. But we had to, this last winter, had to duck bullets until we found out who was shooting. My wife and I were working in our wood area trying to improve it a little bit. And pretty soon the shooting. And this is in one of those nearby apartments. The dogs came from a short distance away. There are many who want a house and lot in the country with only large farms around them. It has been recognized in the Columbia Gorge area there are those that want it developed but not let anyone else develop, of course, because they want the scenery maintained and somebody else. And I happen to have preserved a woodlot, and my wife has planted thousands of trees over the last 30 years. Several hundred to several thousand each year in those areas that are not easily farmed, but they're still productive. Those trees are growing. Not only is there beauty, there's production there, real production. That it isn't buying and selling land does not create new wealth at all, but growing crops does. I think Senate Bill 237 opens the door on some lots of record, maybe too much, but it and that part of it I would like to see restricted. during our process of hearings in Marion County for our land use laws, we started out with types of zones, and it was experimental, of course, and it changed the zoning designation. But when it come to originally many, perhaps most of the farmers were opposed to zoning. They still wanted to do their own thing. But pretty soon they saw that they were not only not able to do their own thing, which was to farm, but they were being restricted because neighboring farmers were putting up more houses and mobile home lots and so forth.
Madam Chair.
And during that time, a lawyer got up at our hearings and he said, "People, I want to advise you. Divide your land now as fast as possible, because as soon as this goes through, you'll no longer be able to if you got any kind of land, divide it." He had farmland of his own.